Some airplanes are remembered for the records they set, some for the wars they won. And then there's a small, strange category of machine that aviation remembers almost against its will, because the story is too good and too terrible to let go. I'm Taildragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we are talking about the GB Super Sportster, built by five brothers in a modest workshop in Springfield, Massachusetts, the fastest piston racing airplane of its era, and quite possibly the most dangerous airplane anyone ever pointed at a row of pylons and told to go flat out. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now let me take you back to Springfield, Massachusetts, around 1929. Five brothers, Zanford, Edward, Mark, Thomas, and Robert Granville. Zanford was the oldest. Everyone called him Granny, which was short for Granville and had nothing to do with the man's personality, because Granny Granville was hard-edged, focused, and consumed by one idea. He wanted to win the national air races. The Granville Brothers Aircraft Company set up shop at the Springfield Airport with modest facilities, modest funding, and thoroughly immodest ambitions. Their early machines were biplane designs, decent sporting aircraft that won some regional events and established the brothers as credible builders, but Granny had been watching what was happening at the Thompson Trophy races out in Cleveland, and watching was no longer enough. The Thompson Trophy, named for Cleveland industrialist Charles E. Thompson, who donated both the prize money and the hardware itself. The race was a closed-course pylon event held at Cleveland Municipal Airport every Labor Day weekend. Pilots flew multiple laps around a course marked by tall pylons set in an oval, pulling tight turns, running their engines at full throttle for extended periods, and flying low enough that the crowd could see the oil stains on the cowlings as they came past.
The crowds were enormous. Somewhere between 100,000 and 150,000 spectators in those years. People drove in from across Ohio and beyond. Families spread out on the grass in front of the gallery. And when the racers came through on the backstretch, you didn't need to look. You heard them first, that wall of sound from 12 and 14 cylinder radials at full throttle that you felt in your sternum before it reached your ears. The smell of hot castor oil and exhaust hanging in the September air. The blur of color and aluminum as a racer went past at 200 miles per hour at treetop level and was gone before you finished the thought. This was what aviation meant to the American public in the early 1930s. This was the spectacle that filled newspapers and movie newsreels and made small children look up at the sky for the rest of their lives. Granny Granville understood that to win the Thompson, you married the biggest engine you could find to the smallest, cleanest airframe you could build. Drag was the enemy. Weight was the enemy. Anything that was not directly making the airplane go faster was coming off. What the brothers produced for the 1931 season was the Model Z. The Model Z was a revelation and a warning, depending on who you asked. Up front was a Pratt & Whitney Wasp Jr. engine, producing 420 horsepower. The cowling was huge and round, completely dominating the profile of the aircraft. Behind it, the fuselage was almost comically abbreviated, short, barrel-shaped. The wings were set low in mid-fuselage, and the cockpit was shoved so far aft that the pilot essentially sat at the base of the vertical stabilizer. Looking at a photograph of the Model Z from the side, it looks like someone drew the engine section with great care and then couldn't quite figure out how to attach an airplane behind it. The design philosophy was deliberate. The more fuselage you had behind the wing, the more wetted area you had. Wetted area creates drag. Granny wanted the absolute minimum fuselage required to carry the tail surfaces. He got it.
The consequence of this approach was an aircraft with extremely tight stability margins. The moment arm, the distance between the wing center of lift and the horizontal tail, was very short. Short moment arm means the tail surfaces have less leverage to correct deviations from straight and level flight. The Model Z was twitchy, demanding. It required constant attention from the pilot. Not the attention you give a well-mannered Cessna 172 on a calm day, the sustained, disciplined, never-relaxed attention you give something that is looking for an opportunity to kill you. The pilot Granny found for the Model Z was Lowell Bales, 30 years old, experienced, with a kind of smooth and economic stick work that sensitive airplanes reward. Bales understood that you had to stay ahead of the Model Z mentally, that you could not be reactive with it, that every input had to be planned a beat before you needed it. He flew the Model Z at Cleveland in 1931 and won the Thompson Trophy at an average speed of 236 miles per hour. 236 miles per hour. In an open cockpit racing airplane in 1931, the aviation world took notice. 3 months later, Bales took the Model Z to Wayne County Airport near Detroit to make an attempt on the world landplane speed record. The record runs were conducted low and fast over a measured course, everything the engine had, trimmed up for maximum speed on one of those runs. The fuel cap on the upper cowling broke loose under the aerodynamic pressure. It came back into the cockpit and struck Bales. The airplane went out of control almost instantly. It hit the ground at speed and came apart. Lowell Bales died in the wreckage. He was 30 years old. The accident investigation determined that the mechanical failure of the fuel cap was the proximate cause, not pilot error, not poor airmanship. A small piece of hardware that failed at the worst possible moment at the worst possible speed. The outcome was the same regardless. Granny Granville absorbed that loss and went back to work. For 1932, the brothers built the R1 Super Sportster. If the Model Z had been dangerous, the R1 was operating on a fundamentally different level. The R1 was powered by a Pratt & Whitney Wasp Sr. producing 800 horsepower. 800 horses in a racing airplane weighing around 2,000 pounds fully fueled. The fuselage was even shorter and more barrel-like than the Model Z. The cockpit was set so far aft that the pilot's eyes were essentially level with the trailing edge of the wing. Looking forward, you saw cowling. You did not see the horizon over the nose until you pushed the nose down. The ailerons were responsive to the point of demanding the rudder. Required constant management. The center of gravity envelope was narrow, meaning small variations in fuel load or weight distribution could push the airplane toward the edge of its controllable range. It was not a machine that accepted distraction. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Granvilles needed a pilot who could do two things simultaneously. Understand precisely what the R1 was doing at every moment of the race, and be skilled enough to stay ahead of it when it decided to test him. That was a short list of people in 1932. They went to Jimmy Doolittle. Those of you who caught our earlier program about Doolittle know his background in instrument flight, the work he did in 1929 that proved blind flying was viable. But Doolittle was not just a scientist in a cockpit. He held a doctorate in aeronautics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he could fly anything. More importantly, when Doolittle sat down in an unfamiliar airplane, he wasn't just feeling it out by instinct, he was building a precise mental model of exactly why it was doing what it was doing, mapping its edges and its tendencies, with an engineer's systematic thoroughness. He talked at length with the Granville brothers before he ever touched the R1's controls. He wanted to understand the airplane's known characteristics, the corners of its envelope, what it would do if he got slow on the backside of a pylon turn, where the center of gravity margins were and how quickly they could tighten as fuel burned off. He took nothing for granted, and then he flew it carefully, building up to speed incrementally, learning its feel, learning its voice. September 3, 1932, Cleveland Municipal Airport, the Thompson Trophy Race. 10 laps around the pylons. The course ran roughly 15 miles per lap, meaning the pilots were covering 150 miles at full throttle, rounding each pylon in a steep bank, working constantly to manage the engine temperature and stay inside the course. The gallery was packed. The September sky was clear over Cleveland. Doolittle flew the R1 the way a surgeon uses a scalpel. Clean on the pylons, carrying energy through the turns, keeping the temperatures in range, staying ahead of the airplane's tendency to want to wander, he did not push it to its limit. He flew it to his own limit, which in this case was more than enough. He won the Thompson Trophy at an average speed of 252.5 miles per hour, a new race record. He climbed out of the cockpit, accepted the trophy, and told the assembled press he was retiring from air racing. He was 36 years old, he had nothing left to prove, and he had recognized, with the clarity that characterized everything he did, that the sport had reached a point where the danger was no longer primarily a function of pilot skill. The machines were operating so close to their structural and aerodynamic limits that even the finest pilot in the world was partly at the mercy of a fuel cap, a connecting rod, a stress fracture, and a spar. He stepped back from the edge before the edge had a chance to come for him. After Doolittle stepped away, the R1 found new hands. The Granvilles were under financial pressure, and the airplane was sold and modified. In 1933, a pilot named Russell Boardman campaigned it in the Bendix Trophy Race, the transcontinental dash from Los Angeles to Cleveland. Somewhere over the Midwest, the R1 delivered its opinion of the arrangement. Boardman crashed on approach to Cleveland. He survived, but with serious injuries. The airplane was badly damaged. The Granville Brothers Aircraft Company did not survive the decade. The Depression had made sponsorship difficult to find, and the accidents, fair or unfair to the men who built the machines, had made the GB name complicated in the eyes of potential backers. Then in the spring of 1934, Granny Granville was killed in a crash, not in a racer.
A routine local flight in a lighter aircraft. He was 33 years old, the company dissolved, the brothers scattered. The machines that had astonished the aviation world for four seasons were wrecked, stored, and gradually reduced to footnotes in the journals of people who had been there. Now here's what I want you to hold from this story. The GB gets discussed as an example of reckless design, a machine built to win at any cost, including the lives of its pilots. There is truth in that. The stability margins were unacceptably thin by any contemporary standard, let alone what we know today. The handling characteristics demanded a level of sustained concentration that very few pilots possessed. But the Granville brothers were not careless men. They were working at the absolute frontier of what anyone understood about high-speed aircraft design in the early 1930s. No computational fluid dynamics, no digital simulation, no accumulated database of high-powered racer accidents to study. They were running their wind tunnel tests at the speeds available to them, which meant the sky above Cleveland and the measured courses at Detroit, and they were generating the knowledge that didn't exist yet. Every failure, every accident report, every crash that occurred in those years of golden age racing. Added to a body of understanding about stability margins and control response and structural limits that the aeronautical engineers who came after them absorbed and used. The men who designed the fighters and bombers of the Second World War knew things about high-powered aircraft behavior that they would not have known without the Granvilles and the Baleses and the Doolittles and all the others who pushed the boundaries until the boundaries pushed back. That is not a justification for the lives that were lost. It is simply the truth of how aviation knowledge gets made when you are inventing the field as you go. There is a flying replica of the R-1 at the New England Air Museum in Windsor Locks, Connecticut, and a static display at the National Air and Space Museum, worth finding. Stand next to it. Notice how short that fuselage is. Notice where the cockpit sits. Notice how much airplane there is in front of the pilot and how little behind. And think about Lowell Bales and Granny Granville and Jimmy Doolittle, three men who bet everything on going fast. One walked away when he chose to, and went on to lead one of the most consequential military operations of the 20th century. One died before he had the chance to make that choice. And one built the machine that made both outcomes possible and didn't live long enough to see what it all meant. That is the golden age of aviation in a few sentences right there. Brilliant and reckless and necessary, all at the same time. Material for today's program came from period reporting in Aero Digest and Aviation Magazine, records at the New England Air Museum, and archival collections at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. More history at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. This has been The Hangar. Stay airborne.